Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to Lions Watch. I'm Marcus Speller.
And I'm Luke Moore.
Each week we're bringing you the big stories and discussion around the England squad for this summer's Euros and tracing England's evolution through the past decade. This week we're looking at the rise of Jesse Lingard and where that leaves Jack Grealish, Jude Bellingham's form, and we're turning back the clock to 2014 and jetting over to Brazil.
That's a lovely touch. Lampard!
Well, that was the worst performance I've ever seen from an England team, ever. We were totally hopeless for 90 minutes.
It's another wretched night for England at a major tournament.
Did you also miss a left-footed player down the left side?
Yeah, but where is that player?
How are we going to win this tournament as England?
And England win on penalties!
Welcome to Lions Watch, everybody.
Or as you said on yesterday's episode of the Football Ramble, we're going to talk about Roy Hodgson in speedos. So I'd look forward to in the second half.
Into the second half. Yeah. First half, I want to talk straight off the bat about Jesse Lingard.
Yeah, and I understand why. And I think we should start off by you making your representations. You could be the good cop about Jesse, and I'll perhaps offer a little bit more realism. But actually, to be fair... I'm perhaps not going to be quite as severe as you and many people listening will expect.
Yeah, well, before the last international break, where Lingard featured for England, of course, when he couldn't get past the San Marino goalkeeper, which doesn't actually bode well for him in this chat.
He got an assist in that game, to be fair.
He did. Yeah. But he hadn't played for England since the finals of the UEFA Nations League in June 2019, when he was cruelly denied a winning goal against the Dutch by VAR. But since his move to West Ham, he scored 8 goals and has registered 3 assists in 9 games. Yeah. He's been magnificent. He's been the form player in the Premier League, you could argue, since then.
Certainly one of them. Certainly English player, for sure.
Yeah.
And also, we have to be honest. How often have you and I, Marcus, sat in this studio when it come up to an England game or a tournament and said, we have to pick players on form, not on reputation?
Yeah.
And there have been many issues with England down the years that we've discussed at length, ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. And one of them certainly has been players who are being picked on reputation. So players who feel like this so-called quote-unquote golden generation was particularly bad for it. But it's happened elsewhere as well, where players all of a sudden become England players and that's it. It doesn't matter what happens, they're always going to be picked. And it happened for a long time. Mm-hmm. Paul Scholes even said it. Scholes said, and you can assess it as being him being hard on himself or being overly negative or whatever. He said on record, and I can tell you exactly where he said it. He said it on Gary Neville's Soccer Box on Sky Sports. He said, I was being picked for England and my form was terrible. Yeah. No one was even acknowledging how badly I was playing. Mm-hmm. No one was acknowledging a drop-off in form. And I was still being picked because they did become at that point, quote-unquote, England players. And we were screaming out for players to be picked on form. Why do they have to do something slightly different? Or why does it have to be seen in different terms for them to be able to put an England shirt on? So on that basis, on the form, if he carries it on between now and the end of the season, he is going to make it very hard for Gareth Southgate to leave him out. And that's something we should be excited about.
It is, yeah. I mean, just on the note about players, I mean, with Paul Scholes, you know, if he's eligible for England, he should always be in the squad. So there is a bit of give and take here, I understand that. But if you're not playing minutes, then you've got to check. Because Lingard could have been one of these players that you just described there from perhaps a bygone era, we hope anyway. Because Lingard started in the games in the World Cup. He was there, as we say, in the UEFA Nations League. Mm-hmm. He could have been one of those players that, it didn't really matter what he's doing at club level. You know, he's an England player. He's going to get in. Well, that's not been the case under Southgate. Now, I know Southgate, with his chat about I'm going to pick players on form and who are getting minutes for their clubs, there are a few little exceptions there which people might hold up to scrutiny. But Lingard himself is not one of them because he's played his way back in to the England setup and he, you know, very active on social media, as we know, and he was messaging, not messaging, I don't have his number. He was posting, you know, it's so good to be back in the setup.
You wouldn't need his number, he'd only need your number.
I think so. Yeah. And you'd go into reply and it just wouldn't happen or something, you know what I mean? He'll call you very much as the situation there. But also, though, with Lingard, with this form and the way he's playing, it's not just the goals and the assists and all the rest of it, it's the feel-good factor, baby.
I was with you up to that point.
No, but there is something to be said. I know this is a slightly minor point and some people might think it's a silly point. But, I mean, it wasn't that long he'd arrived at West Ham. You know, he's been at Manchester United for a long time. So I don't know how well he knew some of those West Ham players. There's a chance he would have rubbed shoulders with one or two of them, of course. But there's little chance with a lot of the other squad.
No, I think it's a good point.
He scores that goal. I forget who it was against. And they strike up the band and do that celebration. Yeah. And everyone's involved. Mm. And there is something to be said about having a character who, okay, it might grate on some people after a while, but there's something to be said about having a guy in the squad who galvanises people, gets people encouraged, and people like being around him. And for international tournaments, they're cooped up in their hotels and whatnot. It's a very, very... it can be a bit stuffy, it can be a bit of a boring atmosphere, and that's one thing Southgate really wanted to do at World Cup 2018. We remember the unicorn and all that kind of business. They learnt from the Welsh side in Euro.
What a summer that was,
eh? But they learnt from the Welsh side at Euro 2016, who said, you know, it was a bit like a lad's holiday. Mm. And Lingard, you know, he's a good club rep, is what I'm saying.
So,
but you get the point,
I'm saying.
Get
your point. Yeah. I think it's
I tailed off a bit there.
No, there's some really interesting points in there. I think that we have to also, if we're going to assess like Jesse Lingard's potential in an England shirt in a tournament, fine, we've made the point that we want to see players picked on form and Gareth Southgate knows him for the reasons you've said and knows what he can bring. And those other kind of intangible things are
has
also
the experience.
Important. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. He's an experienced player.
Yeah.
And whatever happens now, the rise he's had, if he carries this on to the end of the season, and if you look at the fixtures West Ham have, I would argue that... Mm. Losing top four is actually going to be a little bit of a disaster.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
So if he continues this to the end of the season and he's already part of the conversation, from where he's come at the start of the season it's incredible whatever happens. Mm. But here's the but, and here's something you've got to consider I know that you're positive about him and you rate him as a player and that's absolutely cool. Is he going to be able to, A, be given the opportunity to do what he's good at for England consistently in a tournament? Mm-hmm. And B, will he have the wherewithal to do it? Now, what I mean by that is, he is a class of player who is going to immediately improve West Ham, even though they've improved great themselves over the recent season. He just immediately improves them. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he's playing with a very carefree attitude. To me, Jesse Lingard at his best, he tries things, he carries the ball, he's got pace, he can go past a player. If he's not feeling it and he's not doing it, and he's not clearly happy playing, his numbers are actually very, very poor. His actual contribution on paper can be poor. If I thought for 1 second he could definitely automatically transfer how he's playing, what he's doing and how he's approaching it to England and be given the opportunity to do so, I think you'd be a complete idiot not to put him in the squad. The issue is, I don't know if he can do that, and I don't know if he's going to be given the opportunity to do that, and therefore, is it then a waste of a place? And my final point is this. He's not played the same consistent position for West Ham since his resurgence. He's played off the left, he's played in the hole, he's played in different places. He's also been given a bit of a license. Does Gareth Southgate think he can afford to do that for England against, for example, a good team?
Yeah, no, I take your points there. I think actually, though, playing in the hole or playing out wide, you know, Mason Mount, I mean, with that 4-3-3 that we think he's going to play, with perhaps sort of two behind Mount or two sort of shuttling positions with one sort of pivot. Well, Lingard did play that at the World Cup, but he could be cover there. He could also be cover for the positions out wide. But I think your first point is the one that needs more attention, because Lingard is playing carefree. But when he joined West Ham, they're having a fairly good season. They don't have the supporters getting on their back, and we know that that can happen with West Ham. They've got a great support, but it can get a bit feisty, as we know. He hasn't got all that, and it was a bit of a free hit, really, at West Ham, to be honest with you. After his goal in his debut match, I think it was his debut, if I remember.
So the shackles were completely off, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these remaining 7 or 8 games, whatever they've got left, where now there is a bit of pressure, as you say. You look at the run and you think, actually, you should finish top four. And so I think with Lingard, the way I would sort of want to leave this chat with him is, let's see what he does then.
We'll find out a lot about him between now and the end of the season.
Well, I think so. I think that's a good indication. And I think that's probably where he sits with Southgate. It's kind of like, if you carry this on all the way up right to the crunch time, very, very few could argue against that.
The final question was just for you was, I mean, where does he play? Where does he feature? If you say that you've got your first 11, if everyone's fit, if you are going to use Lingard at any point, perhaps for a bit of fatigue as they move through the tournament, if we're fortunate enough to do so, or there's an injury, or he wants to try something different, where does he fit? Because in the game against Leicester, at time of recording, the most recent West Ham game he played, where they go 3-0 up and they win 3-2, he kind of played up front in a weird way with Jarrod Bowen.
Yeah.
And he drifted around all over the place.
But I think that goes in favour. So I think he could be one of those midfield three, actually, or he could play out wide.
You look at Colombia, the England-Colombia game, where they scrape through on penalties. They play a one in front of a back three and a four, then a two, and Lingard's one of the four. I don't remember an awful lot of a contribution in a very protected midfield where he's got a lot of players around him. And I wonder whether he has got that bit of quality that we need, because England can scrape past a Colombia. Of course, Colombia won't be in the Euros, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They can scrape past a team. To me, I really want England to kick on. Me, you and Andy had this debate a while back where we said that I said that England now need to move to the next stage. And you and Andy said, well, no, they don't need to, because it takes a long time. And it took Germany, for example, a long time. But I really want to see England actually do something against a really good team. Here's a game plan. This is how we're going to do it. And we've got the quality to do it. And I don't quite know if Lingard's got the quality at that level. But you're right about what we're going to find out about him in the last 7 or 8 games of the season. If he carries on, they get top four and he's a big star, you can't leave him out. You just can't leave him out, because it makes you completely hypocritical.
Okay, well, I'll finish the Lingard chat with this. It's an email from Taylor, Nicola Henderson. Get him on the bloody plane! I don't care if most of our games are in England. Get him his own bloody plane and fly him directly onto the pitch. That beautiful bastard is our saviour.
Imagine that. Would that get the right impression? Put him right on the pitch. Where's Jesse? He's in the team, isn't he? Yeah, he'll be here in a minute.
Don't land a plane on the pitch.
No.
Helicopter, maybe.
What about like Holyfield Tyson with the fan on the back in the middle of the ring?
Oh, let's be honest. If there's a footballer who's going to get a jetpack anytime soon, it could be Jesse.
That's the kind of thoughtful analysis we're used to. Thank you very much for that.
Indeed.
Jesse Lingard. Jesse Lingard! Fires in a quite beautiful third for England.
Jack Grealish.
Yes.
We talked about Jesse Lingard there. Jack Grealish will be going for a similar position, you'd imagine, especially on that sort of left side of a front three. When we released our squad on the socials last week, a lot of people said, where's Jack Grealish? Yeah. That was the overwhelming, and a lot of people have messaged in, and that has been a big thing.
Bastards.
I mean, we chose three right backs in there. We might have to drop one to fit in Grealish. It's so, so difficult. But what do you think? What's the situation with Grealish? Because we've just talked up Lingard there, and there's so many attacking options. And Grealish, he's a bit injured, but he would be one of those options.
So we included, from memory, we included Henderson and Rice in there because they're so key and we expect them to be back fit. Call me a tinfoil hat man. I wonder whether Grealish has got a more serious injury than we think. And there seems to be information dripping out from Aston Villa that, oh, it's a setback. And it's now, time of recording, there's like another 2 weeks apparently. And let's get this absolutely right. I'm not criticising Jack Grealish. I'm not saying he doesn't deserve to be in there. For me, if he's fully fit and firing, he starts the games for England.
You're starting him?
Would start him. Right. I think he's for all the reasons I've said before.
To be fair, just to cut in, when we released that squad, it was so difficult. We sort of hid behind that injury.
A little bit. But there is a justification because the other criticism we got was, why have you got Henderson in there who's injured and why have you got Rice in there who's injured? Well, the point is, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, both those players have established themselves as really important players for England. It is unthinkable for them not to be in the squad if they're fit. If Declan Rice passes a fitness test 5 seconds before they go or announce it, he'll be in the squad. We have to live in the real world here. That's the reality. Jack Grealish, I think wrongly, for what it's worth, hasn't been able to establish himself as an England regular. Right? So that's why it changes the situation when he's currently injured. That's why we left him out. Maybe the three right back thing was a little bit over the top, but you've got to assess the fact that England, for example, have played three at the back fairly recently, and Walker can play as a right centre back. You've got Reece James, Alexander Arnold, they offer different things. If you've got wing backs, they're different types of players. So there's lots of things to consider. And one thing that we said, Marcus, at the time, which is still absolutely true, is whatever happens, this is a nice problem to have. England are going to have to leave out some very, very good players who could actually make a difference for us. And it's going to be a bit of a lottery.
But on Grealish, I mean, if he came back at the start of May, he would have a handful of games. I'm hoping this for just one's headaches, you know, purposes, is that UEFA do extend the squad to 25, because that will really throw Southgate a bone. And I think that if he did, actually, if Grealish is kind of like 75% fit, I think you do take him and he's an option off the bench. Because Grealish is that type of player, when England are struggling to score, they need something in a game or whatever. And he is that kind of potential ace card, I think.
I completely agree. I think he can do so many things really well that a lot of England players can't do. And for that reason, I told you, for me, on form, he starts. Look at his numbers. Look at what he brings. But it's not about that, is it? It can't be about that at the moment. That's why it is how it is.
Jude Bellingham. Yeah. You saw him against Manchester City.
Another player who, you know, I mean, I was very young, but another player who might miss out. She's crazy given his talent.
You think he's going to miss out?
Well, it could happen.
Oh, I don't know. Not now.
I think
he's a potential starter. That's the way Bellingham, I think he would be mad not to take Bellingham. I think England, in the central of midfield, in the centre of defence, I think they're the areas where England lack a little bit. And I think with what you mentioned about the injuries to Rice and Henderson, I mean, it's crucial that...
For that reason, you think it's almost certain he's going to go?
Well, I think Bellingham's got to go. We saw the way he played against Manchester City the other night, or the other two nights, if you see what I mean, with the both legs. He hasn't missed a league game for Dortmund since early January. He has been magnificent this season. I haven't seen a lot of him because I don't watch the Bundesliga that much, to be perfectly honest with you. And I'm sure some of our listeners might not watch the Bundesliga. That's very presumptuous, but, you know, some of them will, but some of them won't. So for those who haven't, we asked our man Andy Brassel to kind of sum up Jude Bellingham and what he's done in 60 seconds. Here's Andy.
Jude Bellingham's first season at Dortmund has been absolutely fantastic. And considering the expectation that he had to meet when he arrived because of what went before him in Jadon Sancho, because he cost three times as much as Sancho. But he was ready straight away from the season curtain raiser in the DFB Pokal at Duisburg. He looked not just good on the ball, but physically mature as well. That was something that surprised his teammates as well as observers. Torgan Hazard remarked at the time, and in the nicest possible way, he looked like someone who'd played a lot of Sunday football, who wasn't afraid to put his foot in. And even though he's not a player that you can strictly compare to Wayne Rooney, he reminds me a bit of Rooney in the fact that he's never looked like a kid. And because he's someone who can do all sorts of different jobs over midfield, because he's creative, but he'll look after the rough stuff as well, that marks him apart. And I think that gives him a future in terms of the England squad that has so many creative players in midfield now. And he's someone who can knit it all together and do something a little different. And, you know, his age shouldn't fool you. He's ready.
Slightly more than 60 seconds there.
It's an Andy Brassel 60 seconds. It's like a tradesman's 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's a country mile.
For those of you trivia fans, that was 74 seconds. That's roughly about how Andy would see 60 seconds, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, when you get that right up there from Andy and from what other people are saying and so on, he has to be in the squad. I don't think there's any two ways about this. I remember a few months ago, actually, talking to Kristen Hennage, a friend of the show and journalist as well, and he said to me, I think he should start.
Yeah.
And this is it. He, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Bellingham recently in England because of those performances against Man City. And those who have been watching the Bundesliga, as I mentioned on the Football Ramble podcast, it was kind of like, oh, for Christ, you've finally woken up to this guy. But the way Andy describes him in the comparison with Rooney, you know, small comparisons, of course, you do look at Bellingham and you think, nothing seems to faze this lad.
No, yeah, he's got everything. He's got the intelligence of a player far older than he is, and the stuff that he can do, which normally comes with experience, you know, things like intelligence, things like positioning, things like physicality, he seems to already have. The only angle against him really is his age. So you might find, and I'm not saying this will happen. I think, you know, if you put my feet to the fire, I'll tell you now that I think Bellingham will go, and I think it's probably justified that he should go. The only thing I would say, kind of in kind of opposition to that, is just that if Southgate's got such a decision to make, and I think this is actually a moot point now because of the injuries to Henderson and Rice, because you think if one of those doesn't make it, even just one of them, he's obviously going to go. So, but the point I was just going to make is that if you have got such a difficult decision to make, where you've got to fit somehow 27, 28 players into 23, and it is a 23, you might be justified in saying, do you know what, fine. Everyone thinks he's ready. Everyone thinks he's great. Everyone thinks he's a finished article. Everyone thinks he's the best English prospect since Wayne Rooney. He's 17. Next year, there's another tournament. Mm-hmm. He'll be 18 or whatever it is.
He does turn 18 halfway through.
Yeah, he'll be 19.
But I get the point
is, at the World Cup, he's going to be 19 years old. Mm. So what are we losing there by just keeping him back? Mm. All I'm saying is that's an angle that they could pursue if they need to squeeze a certain amount of players into a smaller group, that's all. But I don't think that will happen. I think he will go. I think, as we said last week, if you lose Henderson, you bring in Phillips, and if you lose Rice, you bring in Bellingham. I think that's just how it is at the moment. But Bellingham can do an awful lot more than just that kind of role. He is really a complete midfield player. I read a coaching report of him fairly recently that said he's still so young that he can probably be moulded into anything you want. Mm. Whatever that is, whether that's an attacking midfield player, defensive midfield player, a box-to-box, whatever the kids say these days, a six, an eight, whatever you want to call it, he could probably do all those things. And it's very, very exciting.
Just as well in 1958, Brazil didn't say Pelé's too young.
Yeah, well, that is true, yeah. There you go, the new Pelé. Good luck to him.
Organise a reshape here, and Suarez is in behind England. Suarez to win it! Suarez wins it, surely!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Now it's time to talk about England's evolution, and we're focusing on World Cup 2014. Each week we're tracing the different stages of England's recent evolution to understand the highs and lows that have led up to Southgate's side today. So as we said there, this week we join Roy in his speedos on the Copacabana.
Another way of titling this part of the show is the only part of the show where I start thinking to myself, why are we doing this? So I give myself a really exciting first half. I'm looking forward to the tournament, and I go, oh, yeah, it's normally shit.
Yeah, but, the purposes of this are, as it suggests, England's evolution, just to remember this wasn't that long ago, to how far we've come and how the feel-good factor around England is important, and how it's been moulded and shaped.
How the feel-good factor is so well fostered just because the expectations are so low.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
You live in a freezing house, here's a candle, I've never been so happy. But I also want to say that we want the show to be accessible and interesting, particularly to people who are a bit younger. So they may not remember this. It seems like yesterday to us, but it's actually 7 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And so it is worth just giving people a little flavour, talking about things that maybe have been forgotten, or perhaps people weren't even kind of old enough to properly remember. So let's do it.
Well, and just to add to that, I think that if you look at England throughout the 90s and then the noughties under old Svenigans, I don't think that many lessons were learned. I think the reason why we started 2010 was, well, we've only got so much stamina, of course, but also, actually, before that, I don't think it was that different. I think the only thing that they tried differently was to get a foreign manager in. Yeah. Really, I don't think there was much, hang on a minute, we've got to look at this, and how are we going to approach this differently, and how are we going to try this? And it doesn't mean to say everything you try is going to work, as we will very much find out as we talk about
this
today. And what we talked about last time with Capello into Hodgson.
Yeah.
So I do find this past sort of decade or 11 years of England quite interesting. It's been a bit different, but I think we're in a better situation, certainly. So England, when they qualified for Brazil in 2014, did a fairly difficult group with Ukraine, Poland and Montenegro in there. It was a better Ukraine side than you'd say now. Not that they're terrible now or anything like that. But they did have a couple of sloppy results, though, England. They drew 1-1 at home with Ukraine. I think it was a Frank Lampard penalty late on that sort of bailed them out.
Saved it, yeah.
Yeah, and so they weren't in great shakes. Then they went away to Ukraine, and Roy was playing it sort of very cautious. They drew away to Poland. That may well have been the game when the heavens opened and the game got abandoned. It could have been that game. And Montenegro, I think, was a draw as well. So it was quite cautious.
We have done some research for this, but it hasn't extended to weather reports.
No,
sadly. So we can't confirm or deny.
Well, it was some of the most scintillating television I'd seen.
Oh, they had no plan for it.
Was it Adrian Charles who turned around to Roy Keane and went, oh, "We're hearing it's not a storm, it's a monsoon." I mean, Roy, when does a storm become a monsoon? And he asked him that seriously, and Roy Keane just burst out laughing. He's just like, "Are you really asking me that?"
Yeah.
So we're around this time, and then England. It was quite cautious. It was quite Hodgson-like. We'd seen this at Euro 2012, as we mentioned last time round. Very sort of 4-4-1-1 kind of formation, or a 4-5-1, quite defensive, sort of very zonal. And so nothing wrong with that, perhaps. We're wanting a little bit more. So England go away to Ukraine and draw 0-0. And that was a part of Hodgson's plan to qualify. the journalist didn't quite see it like that after the game, where they absolutely panned him and he looked a bit crestfallen, because he said, well, that'll set up games against Montenegro first, then Poland at home, and we'll beat them. And if we win those two games, then we're guaranteed to qualify. And of course they did, and Andros Townsend was involved.
But there was a little bit more jeopardy, though, because you're absolutely right. And we discussed this briefly before the before we came in. My memory of it was slightly different, as far as that, because of what had come along in the past, England had slipped up against Ukraine at home. They're very lucky to get out of that. Very lucky. A late penalty, as you said. And they'd also shown a little, they could be a little bit shaky. Yes, they did have a situation because they beat Montenegro where they needed to beat Poland at home to have it on their own terms. But the pressure was high because Ukraine were playing San Marino. And I remember Ukraine going about 3-0 up after 15 minutes.
Oh, I mean, that's
and,
a given.
And England still hadn't scored. So it could have... I think for someone like Hodgson, and the way he's managed over the years, and we must remember that England's goal-scoring record in this qualifying group was roughly commensurate with group winners. The Germany, I think they got a few goals more than us. In Bosnia won their group, they got a goal less than us, or a goal fewer than us. So it wasn't unattacking.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's a high strategy for someone like Roy Hodgson, because if you don't get a win against a team roughly similar to a team you've already not beaten at home in this qualification process, you're not going to go through.
When we were burnt with the Croatia match at home with McLaren.
Went to the last game against Croatia, they lose 3-2 and they don't qualify.
Exactly.
This would have been slightly different, because I think England would have gone through to a playoff if they'd not won the group. So it still would
but
have been
still, though, but England have got to top the group, you would think. You're going to go through playoff and all the jeopardy there.
But so, you're right, because there was nothing different. The point being, you're absolutely right. We're still at this point in this cyclical way of playing where we would just pick the best players and what we thought were the best players. And Hodgson was, I think at the time, and you correct me if I'm wrong, was billed as this guy who, do you know what? He knows how to set a team up against better teams. This will work to our benefit in a tournament because when we do play in Italy or Uruguay, who were great at the time, or we even go further than that, which of course we didn't, which you'll come on to, and play at Germany, well, we might be able to get something, because look what he did with Fulham. Look what he did with this other team.
Yeah.
Look, you know, he's very good at setting teams up against better teams.
And a 2-2 draw away to Brazil in June 2013.
But was that a Brazil friendly where they just picked players that are local?
Well, I think it was. No, I don't think it was.
Because they do that sometimes, don't they?
They do, yeah. But even so, though, again, people thought, hang on, that's not too shabby. So England go into the World Cup, and of course, I mean, everybody knows what happens. They crashed out of the group stages of the World Cup for the first time. I think it was since 1958 or something like that, since the 50s, certainly. But the difference was, though, Hodgson moved from a sort of a 4-4-1-1 or a quite defensive to a 4-2-3-1 for the tournament. It was Raheem Sterling's first tournament for England. Yeah. And this is the tournament now where we begin to see a few players that are still there now. Jordan Henderson was involved, for example. And Luke Shaw would get his first minute. They were meaningless minutes, of course, in a dead rubber, but still he played at a World Cup for England. So you think about Hodgson being a bit stodgy and a bit defensive and whatnot. In that opening game against Italy, he played Rooney off the left, Sturridge up top in the middle, Welbeck on the right, and Sterling behind. Four very attacking players. It was quite unlike Hodgson. He went for that sort of 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3 at times, you know. And England started to look a little bit more attacking. We thought, hang on, is he taken off the shackles a bit?
And Sturridge had a devastatingly good season.
Yes.
He had scored so many goals. I think it might have even been the only season he scored anywhere near like that amount of goals.
It might well have been, yeah.
I think he scored 24 in all competitions alongside
Suarez.
Yeah, Suarez, an amazing kind of Liverpool side, amazingly attacking Liverpool side. So for those listening to this through the 2021 lens, it's actually more impressive than perhaps it sounds with Sturridge up front, with Sterling, who was a really exciting young prospect behind him, and Rooney kind of doing what Rooney did. For me, this is a really fascinating tournament in terms of a group stage, because it plays perfectly into a theory that I've talked to you about before and that we've spoken a bit about on the Ramble, which is that everyone looks, when the draw is made for a tournament, about the teams you're getting in your group. And no one looks at the order in which you play those teams. And this is the absolute apotheosis of the example, because I know Costa Rica turned out to be the surprise package. I know this group was the group of death. I know England and Italy went out and Costa Rica and Uruguay went through. But had England caught a cold Costa Rica in the first game and been drawn somewhere, and I'm not making excuses for this, but this has always dogged England. They played in Manaus. It was humidity at 100%. Yeah. It was about 35 degrees. Had the dice fallen slightly differently, they get drawn in another group, they get in a different part of Brazil, which is a massive country, and they play Costa Rica first, it could have been different. Now, I'm not saying that England is worthy of comment to this, on this show, to the point of where everything would have been different and we'd be world champions now. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying to you, one thing we haven't introduced yet, Marcus, into this show or this list of shows leading up to a tournament is the element of luck. And whether you mm-hmm. like it or mm-hmm. not, that is a huge part of a tournament.
You're absolutely right.
Do you think it would have been different for England?
Possibly.
Had a different order.
Well, because, again, in that Italy game, you know, you look at some of the Italian players, you know, I know they went out in the first round, but they had some seasoned pros in there, you know, Pirlo and the likes.
Mate, the team they had against England,
yeah.
Balotelli was at his peak.
Mm-hmm.
They had Pirlo
Marchisio
doing his thing. Marchisio was playing.
Chiellini.
Yeah, Chiellini and Barzagli, who were both great players. Mm-hmm. They had Sirigu in goal, weirdly. I completely forgot about that.
I think there would have been an injury to Buffon.
Daniele De Rossi, yeah. Marco Verratti. It's
yeah,
a good
exactly,
team.
Exactly, yeah. I remember interviewing Welbeck sort of years after, and he said Chiellini is the best player he's ever right. played against defensively. You know, yeah. It was just magnificent.
Pat List for Welbeck, though, surely.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, come on.
I'm only joking.
Manchester United he played for. I'm only Champions joking. League.
Yeah.
But yeah, England went 1-0 down in that game to a great goal and immediately equalised.
Yes.
Through Sturridge, and you thought, oh, okay, here we go. And again, England, I remember there was a few chances. Wayne Rooney had one a bit later on. England should have got a draw out of that game. They probably shouldn't have lost it. And it was the canniness of the Italians. Once they went up, they defended deep, and in the heat, it was very, very difficult. It's the second game against Uruguay that you're in question. You can lose an opening game to Italy in a World Cup. That can happen. Mm. Unless you're Jack Charlton's Island, it can happen, okay? and England went into that game and they needed something, and of course they go 1-0 down. Mm-hmm. Luis Suarez scores, and it's kind of yeah. like, oh crap. And this is the problem that England suddenly face. And I friends of mine were at that game and they just saw it. The likes of Leighton Baines playing for England, who hadn't played that much for England before, some of these other players, the fear set in.
Yeah,
the fear gripped them, and he said you could tell that those players. And we'll get to this next week when we talk about Euro 2016, which is the nadir of that, you could argue. Yeah. But the fear sets in and they go, oh my goodness, we're going out. Mm. We're on the precipice here. Mm. And I don't want to be the one to mess it up even further.
To what extent do you think that bleeds through to the players?
I think the players do feel that, definitely. Okay. I genuinely do. And the friends of mine in the stadium, I mean, if you couldn't see it on TV, they said, you can see it, the body language. They were quite close to the pitch. You can just see they get the ball and they think, no, not me. And they play a simple pass. Whereas you're 1-0 down, you need something. Mm. And who was the man driving them on? It was Wayne Rooney. Mm. And Rooney gets the equaliser, his only World Cup goal, it would turn out. And you think, right, get out of there yeah. with a point. And then, of course, a mistake.
That was a kind of scuff cross by Glenn Johnson. Rooney
That's
comes
right.
at the far post.
And he's there. Yeah. And you think, okay, brilliant. So if you set up the last game, you need to beat Costa Rica to go through and all the ramifications, which obviously didn't happen, then okay, that's not too shabby. But then there's a mistake and Suarez punishes England and out they go. But this was the problem around that time is, and it would bleed into the next tournament. There was still that talismanic complex around Wayne Rooney.
Yeah.
And England, he was the only one who's tried to do something and he was so close to doing it. But the players are almost looking at him going, oh, Wayne, it's down to you, mate, kind of thing. And that puts more pressure on Rooney, and you can't have a team play like that.
So the reason I asked you how much you think that affects the players is because I think particularly in this game against Uruguay, from my memory, mm-hmm. I didn't watch this game back before the show today, but I remember it fairly well, is that this sounds a bit like a cliche and sounds a bit like an old school thing to say, but mm-hmm. forgive me. Because football's become what it's become, mm-hmm. and it's a lot more skill-based and a lot more athletic and all the stuff that we know about, I think people are sometimes seduced into thinking that actually being tough, working hard and showing some fight isn't as important. It is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think if the fear factor bleeds into the players to the extent that you say it did, and I've got no reason to doubt you, against a team like Uruguay, it's absolutely fatal. Mm. Because that iteration of that Uruguay team were rough house street football players mm-hmm. who will... I mean, listen, Cavani's amazing and he's a football royalty. Suarez is a ridiculous player. He's a generational player. And I know people hate that phrase, but he is. But they also knew how to fight. They had full of really tough players. And the first thing they needed to do, England, with players who've got experience, well, I mean, he's not had experience then, but players like Gerrard, players like Rooney, players like Henderson, they had to fight and they didn't fight. Mm. And they didn't earn what we would be told as kids, Marcus, he didn't earn the right to play. Mm-hmm. Get your foot on the ball, get the ball back, show them you're not going to be bullied because it's such a high-pressure situation. It was always going to be Suarez. Mm. That's just how football works, right? He comes off the back of that amazing season in the Premier League.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He gets banned after this game because he gets banned for about 9 games and doesn't play any further part in the World Cup after the Italy game. He was playing on the edge all the time. I didn't see enough England players playing on the edge there. And if I'm being totally brutal, you've also got it peppered with players who probably weren't quite good enough. So yeah. Lambert comes off the bench, Adam Lallana, you know, Ross Barkley's flat to deceive in his career, Phil Jagielka, mm-hmm. You know, to an extent Leighton Baines. Great pros, mm. you know, great, worthy Premier League players.
But to beat that Uruguay side.
Yeah.
And also as well, that's why I remember being in the pub when Rooney scores, and I just remember thinking, get out of there with a point.
Mm.
Get out of there. And it's that street wisdom and the ball yeah. goes over and nonsense.
The finish for Suarez's goal as well.
Oh, well, he meant that, didn't he?
And no mucking about yeah. top corner stuff.
But I want to finish this chat with Hodgson's failed campaign in 2014 by saying in the last game, Frank Lampard retired after that tournament.
Yeah,
he didn't start against Uruguay or Italy, I don't think. But we talked about the anger of South Africa with some of the England players. When the England players went off, against Germany. It was the anger of the England fans, sorry. Against Costa Rica, it was actually quite good atmosphere, quite oddly. And the fans didn't give England pelters, as the England team were expecting. And Lampard, he retired, said it was a really tough decision, even at the age of 36 or whatever it was. But some of the England players who did retire after the tournament, it was one or two, they actually nearly reconsidered because of the reaction of the fans. That was one of the things. I remember them saying that, and they were like, we really appreciate that, almost like the send-off we got at that tournament. Very, very different to previous England tournaments.
But it's also because, there's a couple of reasons for that, I think. One is because people had a chance to get used to the idea they're out.
Possibly.
So it wasn't they weren't experiencing mm-hmm. elimination at that moment. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it's easy to forget that fact because that was the most forgettable England game in World Cup history. Yeah. It was, wasn't it? It was 0-0. Yeah. I mean, Costa Rica mm-hmm. were, you know, they'd gone through and they had a really good tournament by their standards, and but England were already out, and he played a few players, as you mentioned in the past, your Ben Fosters and people like that, who had a chance to experience World Cup football, but it was a waste of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I watched out of duty rather than...
I know what you mean.
And so that it was always going to be a bit of an odd one.
Yeah.
You know, so...
But it did give Luke Shaw some experience.
It did, and look where he's got to now.
Yeah.
He'll certainly be part of the conversation in weeks to come. But summarise this by... But how do you see this looking back? So do you think this we're still part of this cycle where we're still making the same mistakes, we're still doing the same things wrong, we're just finding the best candidate to manage England rather than have a plan, and he's just chucking all the players in together? Because my issue with the Hodgson thing in retrospect is kind of similar to the Hodgson thing with Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
He can do it with players who aren't quite at that level because he makes it about repetition, he makes it about patterns, he makes it about systems. Mm-hmm. One, he can't do that because he doesn't get enough time with the players at England. Mm-hmm. And two, the players are too good for that at this level.
Yeah.
That's probably looking back on why he became unstuck and why it reached its nadir in 2016, which we'll find out next week.
Absolutely right. Thank you very much for listening to Lions Watch, everybody. We'll be back next week, as Luke said, with more news and discussion and a trip back to Euro 2016.
Can't
Don't worry,
for that.
It gets better after that. Nice one. See you next week.
See ya.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.